And Magnus, I told you, buddy. I told you that those Indian kids were coming and that you were feeling invulnerable at the top when you abdicated your throne as if it was some cheap silverware. Sorry, son. They're coming for you now. It's time to get back in it.
Folks, welcome to Dojo Talks. Today we will be discussing the latest U.S. Chess Championships, the U.S. Championship, U.S. Women's Championship that just concluded yesterday. The winners, spoiler alert, Fabiano Caruana won the U.S. Championship, his second in a row. He won last year as well. It's his third overall title. The Women's Championship was won by IM Carissa Yip, her second title. She won also in 2021. The U.S. Women's Championship was very, very hotly contested. Fabi, he clinched with a round to spare. It was very clear he was leading almost the whole event. The women's event, though, was very, very close. It was basically down to Carissa and Begum Tokirjanova that were basically just crushing the tournament. It was only decided in the last round when they both lost. It was very dramatic. It was very similar to that 2013 candidates where Magnus lost the last round, Kramnik lost the last round. Magnus ended up qualifying for the World Championship title. But yeah, we'll be talking about the event. I was covering it for St. Louis as usual. I was writing the recaps after each round. So I definitely was following it quite closely. And yeah, super fun event to follow. Of course, we know a lot of these players, and it's fun to see all the top players play. It's fun to see all the juniors coming up and showing their potential as well. Yeah, honestly, the closing was just last night. I'm still recovering, to be perfectly honest. Yeah, it's such a long tournament. At the end, I mean, I think everyone just wants to let, like, all the players, the arbiters, the staff, you know, everyone's just exhausted at the end of the, it's very long, 11 rounds, two rest days. Yeah, definitely one of the, I mean, I would say the most important event all year for the United States.
Two rest days. I would want to keep going.
Yeah, I mean, it was brutal. Well, first question for you guys, our usual starting question. How much did you follow the event? How interested were you in this event overall?
Go ahead.
Sure, I'll take it first. I was very interested. And I watched the US Championships, which I was more interested in. I watched it live basically every day. I think sometimes I had to go to bed before the last game finished or whatever, but I got to watch a lot of it. The time slot was pretty good for me because it was kind of like right as my kids would go to bed, they would play, and I could watch pretty much the whole thing. The women's championship, I watched a lot less. Why? I don't know exactly. I guess I have more to learn from like the 2700 games, so that's probably why. Or maybe it's just like my habit. Like whenever 2700s play, I watch their games pretty much. So that could be for any tournament, but I won't always watch every tournament live. But any game that, you know, shows up at 2700chess.com, I'll click through it. That's just part of my day, like waking up and going to sleep and breathing. So I watched it. I found it pretty interesting. I guess I'll pass it to Jesse there.
Sure. Yeah, for me, it was less about like the drama of who's going to win it and the individual storylines. So, for example, this Mishra kid, we're going to talk more about him later, but that was an amazing storyline. Is how real is this kid? I'm not sure yet, but this was like a really indication that the kid, big indication that the kid is for real, right? And even though he's American, it's still kind of also part of this bigger question we're going to have to do a Dojo Talks on, which is the Indian chess boom, right? It's just a stunning thing. And I would say this last week with a Cutter Masters, and then this thing going on with Mishra. It's just like, oh my gosh, it's like we're just taking over. In fact, quick thing, I was doing some opening work today and I was reviewing games from like the 90s and early 2000s, all top games, all Eastern European names, or European names, you know? And now we're just like, it just hit me like what a big transformation is happening in the chess world at the top. Mm-hmm. Also interesting, Neiman. You know, Neiman gets a chance to play this tournament. You know, he's allowed to play, of course. How real is the kid? The kid has a lot of pressure on him, of course, because if he doesn't perform at a plus 2700 plus level, then people are going to be doubting, you know, all this stuff, right? He's doubting himself, right? That was an interesting storyline to me. Friend of the dojo, Sam Shankland. This kid has worked hard to be over 2700. I think he's fallen below 2700 now. And that's hard, dude. That's just like that. That's a big pressure on him to get back over. And arguably, you know, this whole thing also we got to talk about with in terms of the ratings is the rating deflation thing seems like it's very real, that it's finally reaching the top, right? Touching the coconuts of our friend Sam, you know? So that might be happening there as well.
Yeah.
With the women,
Maggie, nobody's even anymore. It's touching Maggie this week. So
it's really touching Maggie, man. Well, in fact, Magnus, it might be time for me to give you my announcement, boss. I was going to save this for later, but your name has been dropped.
But it's the U.S. Championship episode.
Listen, buddy. The reason that this is why it has to do with the U.S. Championship. Fabi is now had a couple hard years, and now it's looking like he's coming back over 2800. Okay, beautiful. I, as a fan of Fabi, had some doubts because he was like doing podcasting stuff. And I was like, maybe his heart is no longer in it to win it. Maybe he's just relaxed even from doing the podcast. Maybe it allowed him a little bit of extra freedom. He's doing great. And Magnus, I told you, buddy, I told you that those Indian kids were coming and that you were feeling invulnerable at the top when you abdicated your throne as if it was some cheap silverware. Sorry, son. They're coming for you now. It's time to get back in it. You still have a chance, boss, before it's all taken away from you, because they're blooding your nose hard now, son. They're blooding it hard now. And it's time to just come to grips with reality that it's not easy. It's not going to be easy no matter what. You've had it easy. Now you know what struggle for the rest of us looks like, son. It's time to get back in the ring. Okay? There it is. That was my little Magnus rant. That had to come. Definitely part of the U.S. Championship story, though, because both of these championships are happening side by side. And the other thing, storyline, Naka, where are you, buddy? You're too arrogant to be part of the U.S. Championships. What's going on, bud? You afraid? You afraid of losing? I don't know what you're doing over there. This was you, buddy. I remember we played in the U.S. Championship together ages ago, and now you're like, oh, is it some chump tournament? No. What are you doing, buddy?
It's a super tournament now. It's a super tournament.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, I have more rants, but I'm going to pass it to Kostya.
I think on Naka, I think Fabi was saying on his podcast that Naka had some other event planned for U.S. Championships that fell through. And by then it was too late. Like, he had already declined his invitation. So he decided to go play Qatar instead. And he's also playing the Grand Swiss that's starting in like 4 days. Actually, a lot of the U.S. champs players are playing Grand Swiss. Like, Fabi's playing. I think Mishra's playing. So a bunch of the contestants there. Interesting to see how they do, because, of course, it's very, very close. And they have to travel to Isle of Man, which is several flights. Got to go to Europe, then Dublin, Isle of Man. It's like, it's a whole thing. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, on Naka, it's like, I kind of get it from his point of view. There's not a ton of upside to him to playing the U.S. champs. Like, either he wins.
He could win it.
Or
be a champion.
He's already won it. He's already won it a couple of times. If he doesn't win it, though, then it's like, yeah, kind of, a failure of a performance. And it doesn't really help him get into the candidates, which is what I think he actually wants, right? So Grand Swiss, that's a direct qualifier. Qatar Masters, maybe like nice warm up, and he's closer in terms of the travel. But maybe he would have played, like, if it had worked for his schedule. It sounded like he just had a conflict at that point. But I don't know. I mean,
You said like 3 minutes ago, Kostia, that this was the greatest tournament of the year for the U.S. So I think you yourself have given a very good argument for why he should have played if he could have.
Yeah, fair enough. U.S. champion goes down in history. And, you know, I think people do count the number of titles that you have, which is definitely important. Yeah. I don't know. I could see why it wouldn't be the most important event for someone of that level. So, but I agree with Jesse. Fabi looks great this tournament. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he also, you know, he qualified through the World Cup recently for the candidates. So definitely like he seems to be in great shape. And he's playing Grand Swiss now. It'd be interesting to see if he wins that as well, because he's already qualified for candidates. So that I wonder how that will affect things. I feel like he U.S. Championship was very interesting. I mean, it's like he, Mishra, and like, yeah, no one else. I think only he and Mishra enjoyed the tournament, like through and through. Hans was doing very well. Like he was in clear second place, like halfway through for a number of rounds. And then he, I think he lost this game to Fabi, and then he definitely kind of stumbled at the end. But yeah, for the most part, it just seemed like just a handful of players were enjoying the tournament. Fabi, Mishra, Carissa Yip, Begum. And that was it. Everyone else is just like struggling up and down. With the exception, maybe Alice Lee. Alice Lee started off poorly, half out of three, but then finished 7 out of 8. So I'm sure she was quite pumped by the end of the event.
You're referring to a very interesting general phenomenon, Kostia, which I pondered back when I was a more competitive chess player, which is, you know, sometimes people say that chess is sort of like an equal sum game. Like if you win, someone has to lose, or if you lose, someone else gets to win or whatever. But I really thought when I was playing competitively that chess was a really negative sum game, because everybody's expectations are always above their ratings, but on average, everybody performs at their rating and everybody wants to do better than they actually do. And so I think it's very common. You've got about 20% of people who are happy with how they're doing and 80% of people moaning about how they got unlucky or how they weren't feeling well or their opponent bothered them during the game. Like I mean, it's a bunch of mumbling, grumbling, whining.
Yeah, actually, that's true. And in chess, you either win or you suffer.
But it's like you have to almost win the tournament or you suffer. You know, it's like it's really like intense how high people's expectations are and how much suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of chess players, I definitely have this experience where if I lose like two games, that's it. I just forget who I am. All the games I've won, I'm just like, I don't know how to play chess anymore. I just don't know how to win it. I just don't know how to do it anymore. That's how it starts feeling. And then when I finally win a game after that, I'm like, oh, wow, I haven't felt this in a very long time, even though maybe it was a couple of days.
Haven't bathed in adrenochrome in so long.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's lots of cool storylines from this tournament. I think maybe talking about Mishra would be a good start. Mishra definitely impressed from my perspective. Mm-hmm. David pointed out that he won 5 games, which was just as many as So, Dominguez, and Aronian combined. So that was a lot of wins he made.
One tiny kid. Well, he's not that tiny, but one fierce, medium-sized kid versus 3 elite super GMs.
Yeah. Well, Levon definitely had a bad event. I don't think he was playing well. So and Dominguez, I mean, they both scored 2 wins, 9 draws.
Yeah.
So no losses. They tied for second with Mishra. Mishra had like 5 wins, 3 losses. He had to just battle through Mordor to get there. But I don't know. I think it was very impressive, especially some of his wins were very high quality. His game against Aronian in the last round was extremely nice. I'm a chump, I am, but it didn't seem like Levon just like blundered something simple and it was just like easy. It was just like a very well played game for Mishra from what I saw.
My feeling
was fighting. Yeah.
Was that Levon was kind of tired. You know what you said about people being tired at the end? My feeling was that like Levon like didn't even want to play another game. Like he just wanted to go. And then here he gets paired against some kid who actually wants to play chess and ugh. What a horror, you know, go to a chess tournament and run into somebody who wants to play chess. What are you supposed to do? And yeah. he got beat down.
Yeah, and earlier Levon, he had that he allowed that repetition out of the opening against Andrew Tang on like move 5 mm-hmm. in the London. Yeah. And definitely, I mean, he didn't have to allow that, I don't think, as black, but yeah, already that was kind of showing maybe some lack of fighting spirit even there.
Yeah.
First, let me ask you something.
Some lack, yep.
To get a flavor of the event. So years ago when, so, you know, I saw Mishra at a bunch of these tournaments and his dad was like this very imposing, intimidating force who was like constantly behind him, like hovering around the kid, sometimes shouting at him in public. And, you know, I think it was mildly reminiscent of Gadakhmsky's father, nothing nearly as that bad, but it was still, you know, that sense you get of like, oh my God, this kid has got this huge father figure behind him that's also a coach and kind of a yeller. And so I wanted to ask, has that evolved? What's the dad's presence like there at the turn?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not like around the playing hall too much, but I can say I didn't really notice anything too significant like that. I did see his dad at, I think, the opening and the closing. Mm-hmm. But that was basically it. Right. Not like, yeah, not a huge presence.
Kostya, I've never been there. At the U.S. Championships, could you stand over someone's board or do they have like a cordoned off area to play in?
You mean for spectators?
No, you can't stand next to the board.
For the players.
I mean, it depends which direction you look from, but are the spectators separated from the players or the players from the spectators?
So the pandemic, and especially since the last year's Sinkfield Cup, they've stopped allowing spectators into their closed events. So
they're not even in the room. They're like downstairs in a room with Yasser or something.
Yeah, yeah. So there's no spectators allowed into the playing hall.
So there would be no way for his dad to be standing over the board at this event.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
No, and that was the case, too, like even back in the day when we did U.S. championships in the beginning of St. Louis. It was always upstairs, and then you were wanded. People were being wanded long before the Neiman scandal happened, you know. And then, yeah, spectators are downstairs or somewhere else.
No, yeah, they used to allow spectators up to see like U.S. Championships, Sinkfield Cup, like all these big events. Spectators would have to be wanded as well. So right. They weren't allowed to bring up phones or electronic devices. But yeah, there was definitely room for people to watch. And someone was saying, Leonard Utz, the main photographer, he was saying it's a very different vibe when there's spectators in the room versus when there isn't. I feel like I could feel that a bit as well, because I would visit the club a lot and see the games in person. And yeah, when I don't know, you can always like feel this tension when there's like a lot of people in the room, and especially like the Sinkfield Cup, like Magnus is playing, like all these top players are there, people are watching. I do kind of feel like there was less quick draws when there's spectators in the room. Somehow the players just feel more awkward about taking a quick draw when there's a bunch of people watching like in person, you know, and you could just be right there. But yeah,
I would want spectators in the room. I would want them to be there when I sacked my piece and crushed somebody. You're playing for the spectators. I want them in the room cheering. I mean, silently, but I can feel it coming off of them, how excited they are.
I mean, I think it was fun, especially like, you know, one player would make a move, spectators like move over to their board. You know, you can like, yeah, you could really sense the tension.
Yeah.
And, I'm sure in the last round, of course, it was probably super, super tense inside the playing hall, especially like on the women's side, because you had like Carissa and Begum that were basically, for anyone not following the event, I mean, it was wild. Like, a couple of players started off well, but then Carissa and Begum just started winning like every single game. At a certain point, I think they both won 4 games in a row. I think Begum then won a 5th game while Carissa drew to like take the lead. And then they like both just like kept winning. I mean, it was crazy. And very, very unexpected, because this was actually like, I think it might have been the strongest US women's champs ever, or like strongest in a while, for sure. This is very, very competitive. So it's unexpected to see that. Mm-hmm. Let's see. It was good to see Hans back as well. You know, I saw Hans at a couple tournaments earlier this year, like in Vegas, mm-hmm. when the lawsuit was still ongoing. And he like wasn't talking to anybody. He was just like going straight to his board, then going home. This tournament, though, actually, I saw him like socializing a bit. He was socializing at the closing ceremony, like interacting with the players. I was actually kind of happy to see that. I mean, he's still just like this teenage kid. Okay, he's 20 now, but he's like this young kid. Definitely felt like ostracized from what I can see from the community. I was actually just kind of happy to see him back, like on a human level.
Yeah, there was a picture from like the players meeting, maybe at last year's tournament or something like that, where he's like sitting all by himself and then everybody else in like a row together. Mm-hmm. It was very.
Yeah, and that would have been a month or two after Sinkfield Cup. So yeah, not surprising. But yeah, it's good to see him back. His interviews are definitely still very entertaining.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, I was wondering, I don't know, maybe you guys have some thoughts, like who will be higher rated between him and Mishra in, I don't know, a year or two? Because Mishra, he seems super motivated, Hans as well, but Mishra, I mean, explicitly wants to be the youngest ever 2700. You know, that's his next goal. Mm-hmm. And he was very impressive just in terms of his maturity too. Just like, he's like there to play chess. You know, he's just like working super hard, reviewing the games. I mean, he just seems locked in, absolutely locked in. Mm-hmm. And Mishra did break 2600. Yes. Yeah, during this event. He gained something like 20 points and he's now like 2615 live FIDE rating. 14 years old.
Yeah, boss. No, it's obvious to me that Mishra is going to surpass Neiman quickly. What are we talking about? Give me a break. Wow. I mean, Neiman's going to struggle to make 2700 ever again, dude. Mishra's on the path. Mishra, dude, could be a contender for the whole thing. For the whole thing, dude. You know? Oh, man. Yeah, for sure. And that's where, you know, when you start thinking about U.S. talent, and if Mishra goes on the same path that he's now on, well, then we have our team is even stronger, dude. You know, amazing. Our team is stunning, you know. So, no, I don't. I think Neiman, I think he's going to struggle to make 2700. And that's going to be a hard road for the dude. But Mishra, I expect to be there, I don't know, a couple of years, yeah. Might not even be that long.
Neiman's also going to be 2700 again, probably.
Okay. But I'm just saying, he's just going to pass the money. He might make 2700 again.
This is why I want to do the draft. I want to do this show where we draft juniors, because I bet we have lots of disagreements about who's going to be the highest rated in a couple of years. I think it would be.
Yeah. So but Mishra was amazing at this tournament. And really the question is, you know, do any of us think that this was an aberration, or is he already as good as his performance rating here? Which was, let's say his performance rating was probably something like 2756 or something like that.
Pretty high, dude. Yeah.
Well, he definitely showed some very good chess. I mean, I would say like his strength clearly seems to be his level of calculation. I think I told David this story before, but at the opening ceremony, there was a few of us trying to solve this endgame study. and we're working on it for like 5-10 minutes. We figured out maybe the first 3-4 moves, like me and Katerina Nemtsova, is women's GM. And then we called Misha over, and you know, I was going to tell him like, all right, here's what we figured out about this study. Maybe you can help us figure out the rest. And then Katerina was like, no, let him catch up. We need the extra time. And sure enough, like he just started looking at the position just like a, like an engine, you know, just going like variation 1, variation 2, variation 3, variation 10 seconds, guys. He had caught up to what it took us like at least five minutes, like calculating, like trying to figure out 10 seconds. He had caught up to us and was already surpassing us, you know, finding the next move of the solution. And so his calculation, I mean, is just like insanely fast. His weakness may be more just on the opposite side of things. Like he lost this game to Hans actually with white that I thought was very interesting, where it was very technical game. And Hans honestly didn't make it even look that hard. It was just this like purely positional effort. Misha made like a couple of inaccuracies, ended up worse in an endgame, and then was just losing a couple moves later. So that might've been, an area for him where he can still improve his chess when there's not like
he
a ton.
He played very hopelessly that game.
Yeah.
That game was like abysmal, honestly. That one game, that one.
Yeah, and I feel like there wasn't a lot to like calculate in that position exactly. And so he like tried to do something and then it ends up backfiring. So clearly he's not, perfect player like 2700 just yet. But I mean, yeah, if he just keeps playing some of those games, also just like his fighting spirit, like, you know, this game he won against Shanklin, like, Shanklin blundered, you know, deep into the end game. But like that was just such an intense game, like through and through. Yeah. And he had to like really exert a lot of energy to actually win that one.
That is the game I was thinking of in terms of how impressive he is to me, because that was like a game where he was in a bad position out of the opening. And he turtled up, and the toughness that he showed, that was like just huge to me. The toughness and grit in that game to just like sit there on your back foot for so long and also to still play for a win from that position. I mean, I just thought that was incredible.
Yeah. I want to say a couple other storylines that really I'm interested in. Dominguez is always fascinating me. First of all, the guy is now 40. And if you don't know, like what happened was, he had a hard leave from Cuba. And it was very difficult for him to come here. He had to like sit out for like a year to just become eligible to play in the United States because he didn't want to pay the extortion fee that FIDE wanted. And dude is just bringing it after 40, which is so impressive. Here, you know, great tournament. And so that guy is like kind of an unsung hero. I would say he's like number 4 or 5 in the US, right? And that guy's amazing to me. Aronian had a hard tournament. He's also over 40 now, you know? So it's like, oh man, Aronian, once a contender for the title, having trouble with the chumps of the world US Chess Championship, right?
Well, ooh, that's gotta be hard, dude.
Let's just say there aren't really that many chumps in the US Championships anymore. I mean, well, like if you count players who are rated 2698, we've got like 10 super GMs, right? It's like that's one of the things about this tournament overall. It's like where are the outsiders or the chumps? There's like it's just so tough now. Such a deep field.
Yeah. Okay, but I mean there's a clear difference between like Caruana's performance and Levon's performance. And, you know, a couple years ago, they were both just like clear 2800s. You couldn't say like one is better than the other or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Aronian's really, poor dude. I mean, you know, it's one of the things that happens with age. Hey, Magnus, you listening? With age, you're going to start tanking a little bit, man. It's just going to be unavoidable. And for the most part, he's held it together. And then now, you know, really fell down, dude. He's down to 21 in the world after this tournament, dude. That's the lowest he's been in probably since he was a teenager, you know? So that was an interesting thing to keep watching as well. Sevian, I've known that kid for a long time, and you know, it's hard for that kid to prove himself as well as Jeffrey Jean. Those kids are both incredible players, but right, like you're battling it out, trying to make it into this 2700 club or stay in the 2700 club. It's a hard life, dude. Robeson as well, dude. That kid keeps coming, man. That kid 2007 was the future of US chess. And, you know, again, one of these players hovering just below 2700, working all the time at it, you know, having some success. It's rough. It's rough, but it's also fascinating to follow. Of course, Shanklin, friend of the dojo, we're wishing him the best. Hard, dude. So, you know, what Kosta was saying about the event not being enjoyable. I mean, it's a slog, dude. And it's long. it's a hard life.
Yeah. Oh, let me just elaborate a little bit more on my comment about there not being chumps. I mean, like, yeah. Wesley So and Dominguez, they each only won two games. So it's not like they were, you know, running through people.
No.
Right? I mean, they had a good result, but the tournament is so strong that plus two is, you know, a satisfactory result for a top 10 player at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, the tournament's like super strong. Aronian won one game. They each won two, right? He got tired and lost to Mishra in the last round. Mm-hmm. He had one tough game with Black against Neiman. That's kind of the difference, is that he lost. That's really the big difference between how he did and how they did, is he lost two games. But in terms of being able to churn out wins, I think it's really a standout performance by Fabi that he was able to win a bunch of games, because wins were really hard to come by in this tournament because there's a dearth of chumps.
I'm going to ask you guys, this is kind of a humorous question, but I think there is something mildly serious to it. You know, let's imagine that Fabi had a more scowling face, because he has such a pleasant face. It looks like he's not going to kill anybody when you meet him or you see a picture of him, right? But let's just imagine he had the scowl of, say, a Korchnoi or a Kasparov or sometimes a Bobby Fischer. If he had that kind of scowl and you matched it with the way he plays chess, which is just full balls all the time, taking risks every single game, you would have a different perception of him. But because he looks like he's not going to kill anybody, it's kind of hard to match like the persona and what I see when I watch the kid play, right? I mean, every time he's taking incredible risks and he's comfortable in that place of incredible risk. And sometimes it doesn't work out. Right. But I just think it's interesting that I think everyone would see him differently if he had the scowl, you know, but he doesn't have the scowl. But if you look at his games, it's like you're either going to think of him as some kind of crazy, I don't know, Shaolin warrior or something, or like a tightrope walker. That's what I sometimes think of him. He's always taking those risks. I just see him out there balancing. Oh, it's so easy to knock the dude off and he never falls, you know. So anyways, the guy has a very interesting style that maybe we would even want to talk about at some point, because it's been working for him, the extreme risk taking, you know. Maybe
I think a big piece of the Fabi package is normally high confidence. And to play super riskily goes better if you're really confident, right? Than if you're, you know, hesitating and scared the whole time. And I think the little dip that he had for a couple of years, and I don't know what the reason was, but he had 2 years where he went down a little bit and Jesse wasn't feeling like he was about to be world champion. And it was really disappointing for Jesse. But I think that little dip, whatever it was, it messed with his confidence and he didn't have his normal confidence just during those 2 years. And now it seems to be back here. So.
Right.
I remember the first couple times I saw him play against Magnus and I thought, oh, this dude's not afraid of Magnus.
No.
And at the time, everybody was afraid of Magnus. I mean, even Vichy, when he played a world championship against Magnus, it felt like he was afraid of Magnus.
Yeah.
You know, and then for Magnus, it was weird to play against a dude who wasn't scared of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, also, I think with Fabi, it feels like he really... I agree with what Jesse's saying. Like, he takes a lot of risks, but somehow he's also very focused on like being objective as well. So like he has that objectivity during the game. And I think that helps him against Magnus. Cause it's like, if he calculates and thinks that Magnus is messing up, he'll just try to punish him. And sometimes he misevaluates things. So, you know, maybe he takes too much risk against Magnus, ends up losing. But it's like, yeah, you have to be willing to believe that your opponent has messed up if you're going to actually go after them and try to beat them. I do think Dominguez actually did reasonably well. Like, he had a couple of games, I think, that he kind of left points on the table that maybe he could have won. Like one game against Mishra, Mishra ended up saving. I think he was also winning against Darius during their game. So I feel like actually he maybe could have done even. So I agree. I mean, Dominguez, very solid, maybe even like underrated from the fans' point of view because he just has this like very technical style, but that's really hard to like keep your level, you know, just be this solid without like blundering, throwing away games and collecting wins, you know, with just very precise play. Wesley, on the other hand, he mentioned he was definitely struggling in the tournament. And even the one of the games Wesley won against Robson, he was actually like losing that game for a good chunk of it. And then just in time trouble managed to swindle it into a win. So that wasn't even just like, you know, clean win or anything like that.
Kosti, I have a question for you. The Dominguez game that you referenced with Mishra, was that an opposite colored bishop ending?
Yeah, we saw that one on stream. It was like the middle
one
game
that we watched together, right?
Yeah.
That was a shocking half point save for Mishra. That was also like incredible toughness and defense, the kind of half point you don't expect a kid.
Yeah. You know, absolutely. We were definitely thinking Dominguez is going to convert that one.
Yeah, and the Robson game that you mentioned with Wesley, the whole game, I was like, what's going on? Isn't Robson like winning? What is it possible that he's just winning this game? I didn't have the eval bar on, obviously, but I was like, it feels like he's kind of clobbering White, which I just, it was so hard to believe or expect that I was always like, I must be missing something. Why does it look to me like Black's crushing here?
Right. Yeah.
So it was maybe a little bit of luck for Wesley on that one, huh?
For sure. Yeah, Robson, I feel like he had very up and down event. Like he started the first round. He could have won this game against Sevian. He like had this huge advantage, but he ended up losing. I think he like totally started his tournament off on the wrong foot.
Yeah.
But then ends up winning what I think was the game in the tournament against Zhang. I think that was just like the most beautiful game, like straight out of the 19th century, but just like gorgeous. I would definitely encourage everyone to go check out the game. Robson against against Zhang.
It's a must see.
Yeah. Fantastic. But okay, this level, yeah, you rarely just get like brutal knockouts like that. It's usually just a technical grind, someone slightly better, and they gotta convert, you know. So of course, that's what ends up happening. On the women's side, though, actually, I think there was a lot more interesting games. Like I was, of course, I was covering like both events, doing the recaps. There was a couple of rounds when there was just like six draws in the open section. And and then the women's section is like tons of fighting games. It's not like all the draws were not fighting. I think a few of them actually were very, very fighting. And you know, I tried to do those games justice because for the fans, when they see six draws, it's like, okay, six draws, whatever. Everyone's tired. But a lot of those games, I mean, the players are like, it was like 4 or 5 hour games. I mean, the players are definitely pushing for wins, especially like guys like Shanklin. Like, I don't think he had a short game in the event. Like he's just, you know, every round is bringing as much energy as he can, but it's very hard to win a game. I mean, people are extremely solid and then you have to play perfectly to convert. And, it's not easy. Not easy.
One thing I want to say about the women that's interesting to me as a fan is from my old timers perspective, right? The best women there are Satansky and Crush. Crush, of course, is both of those women have won it a number of times. And there's always been the question of like, well, are we seeing the changing of the guard? And one of the questions that's plaguing US women's chess is which of these women are going at it full time? And at the moment, I would say for the most part, none of them are, except the very, very young who have, you know, maybe not had to face the choice of whether they're going to go to college or not. But we have a number of them in college. And then, of course, Irina and Satansky themselves from let's go, you know, just dial it back. I feel both of those could have played more intently in terms of focusing on their own improvement, right? But for decades now, Irina, you know, actually, I think Irina's big chance actually came at the GM house. She came out, dude. She was ready to study with us, right? For various reasons, though, she wasn't able to like focus down on training just really super intently. And which is a shame, because I think now her time's passed to make, let's say, over consistently over 2,500, right? We have no women in over 2,500. There's 10 women in the world right now that are over 2,500. And I feel like Irina could be there if she really wanted to put in the work, Satansky as well. So from that perspective, even though I feel like they're both of those are the best women in the field, are these young kids going to do something about it? And I think what it would really take to both convince me as a fan and for it to actually happen is for some of these young women who, instead of going big time into college, which of them are going to say, I'm all in. I am all in. And what's cool about the, let's say, just this women's event is if you are all in and you give everything to it, well, at least you're going to get a big, at the very least, you're going to get one big payday from winning the U.S. Women's Championship every year. That is a job in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, not just U.S. Women's Championship. The club is also doing the American Cup now as an annual event. That also has very nice prize fund. And Karen's Cup. Actually, it's funny you mentioned Zatonsky. She won the Karen's Cup this year where the field was mostly like these over 2,500 women. So yeah, clearly like she had that potential. But I mean, I think the whole world is, I mean, just waiting on Alice Lee now. Alice has just this insane potential to just be like a top player, not even like, you know, only top female player, but just top player in general. She, I think we mentioned, yeah, she started off half out of three, but then like, you know, woke up, got 7 out of 8 in the last rounds, like 6 wins, 2 draws, was playing really, really, really some nice games. Yeah, I don't know what happened to her at the start. Maybe she was a little bit nervous or something. It's not clear. Like her first couple of games definitely weren't up to her usual quality. But yeah, Alice clearly seems like the future right now.
Yeah, but I think Jesse framed this question really in an important way, because normally when you've got these promising chess players, the question is, how good are they? What's their ceiling? Can they surpass on strength, the old guard, whatever? But really the question is, are any of them going to be professional chess players? Because Irina was a professional chess player, is a professional chess player, right? I mean, she gave her time, her life, her heart to chess, right? She played tournament after tournament after tournament, whether or not she trained exactly in some particular way. But I mean, she was a chess player, and we've had many promising female chess players in the junior ranks in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. And we've got maybe 4 of them are in college right now and hardly playing chess, right? Carissa, who won this tournament, Annie Wang, who I think maybe a few years ago, I think she may have gotten 2nd in the U.S. championship when she was 16 or something, right? And then she went to college. She basically hasn't played for 3 years. Jennifer Yu,
yeah,
you know, who would even like skip a U.S. women's championship in order to study for school or whatever. I know she played this year, but she missed a year. You know, so many
yeah, no, Jen was saying
too.
So Jen, actually, she's won 2 U.S. women's championships, which is like already incredible. But yeah, she was saying this year, actually, and I think even last year when she won, that she was juggling the tournament and like doing exams and like homework from Harvard. So like not getting a lot of sleep, not doing any prep for the games, like opening prep, because she like just her time is just split, you know. Yeah. So yeah, the problem is they're not just going to school. They're like, you know, they're smart enough to get into like Ivy League schools, which are obviously going to be super, super demanding, like Harvard, Stanford. So, yeah.
When I look at Carissa's trajectory, I think like no doubt she could have been over 2,500 feet a by now if she hadn't gone to school. No doubt.
And one of the weird things too is like with this whole, especially in America, of Asian kids that we have doing really well, part of their narrative, and I hear this from the parents, is, oh, if my kid makes it to such and such level, then that will give them greater chances to make it into Stanford and Harvard. And for a lot of these kids, that's actually been true. That narrative has paid out. And so in that sense, for a lot of these parents and families, the chess journey has to do actually with school, which is like for the chess world, it's like, oh, wait a second. Where'd you go? Where'd you go? You had a spot here. Things were happening.
Yeah. I mean, basically everyone we've just talked about is either at MIT, Harvard, Stanford, but,
and Alice will get the same invites, you know, Harvard, they're all going to invite Alice. Like if she wants, like, I'm sure she'll have no problem getting in.
At the same time, I think somewhere along the way, they must have all loved chess and gone, you know, an extra mile and further than they needed to go to get into a school, right? Like you don't have to win the U.S. Women's Championship to get into school. At some point, you know, you're a world youth, whatever, you know, it's on your resume, you're a master. But I think they got into it. And then for whatever reason, the rug is pulled out of from under the chess career. I wonder, you know, if it's their decision or the parents' decision or whatever. But when it comes to Alice Lee, and I don't like too much pressure being put on kids, but I think it really the question with Alice is not what is her chess potential, but, you know, does she want to do chess as a profession? Do her parents, you know, envision and accept that? I think that's sort of the big question because her talent is insane.
And it is true. A lot of like the students that I worked with, even students at like the World Youth, World Cadet, you know, that are already just some of the top kids in the world, you know, I talk to them and they're like, yeah, you know, I'm doing this. I'm hoping it looks good on the college applications. I'm like, oh, man, but you'd be like a world champion here. You know, like that was the issue I had actually when I was growing up. You know, I wasn't like super talented, but I was one of the top kids in the country. I was playing nationals. But in my head, I honestly did not see chess as a career. I didn't even see it as a thing that people do. It was strictly a weekend hobby for me. It was very similar to how, like, you know, kids do karate or tennis on, you know, on the weekends. And I would often like juggle those things. And it was only later, like I was like 16 or 17, I started learning about like chess culture that I realized like, oh, there's actually like chess is actually a very real thing that people go into and can dedicate their lives into. And I did wish that as a kid, you know, someone maybe like a coach or something would have like sat me down and explained it to me more soberly that they're actually like, you know, like this is like a thing you can do. Yeah.
Right. And have it as a topic of reflection, right? Like, let's talk about this. You don't need to decide now, but let's know that, you know, there are these options and we can think about them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Other sports do have that. Like, I feel like when you have young kids playing like basketball or football, they already have that kind of track in their mind. Like they want to be in the NBA one day or the NFL one day. They want to be a pro athlete, even when they're super young, like 9, 10 years old. As chess players, we don't have that a whole lot, but we do see it. So for example, Mishra has had this goal for many years. I think he's like openly stated he wants to be world champion. I think Magnus probably also early on had like very, very high hopes. So it does happen for sure, but it's rare.
Yeah. And me too, Kostya. I wanted to be world champion.
When you were a kid?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't a little kid because I wasn't playing chess yet, but like in high school, I wanted to be world champion. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Another name I want to mention kind of fits into what we're talking about, also just U.S. championship, is Christopher Yu. I mean, this kid, I'll say I had him at a chess camp when he was 5 years old. And this kid was slain. I mean, it was like talent was just here at the dojo. We're doing a lot of, say, Polgar mate twos. This kid was finding them instantly, way faster than the older kids at the camp. And so I've been watching his progress for years. And I'm little now. He's 17 now, 2600 FIDE, and he hasn't played last, I don't know, 6 months. Hasn't even played. Is it a college thing? Maybe. And he was also interesting that his father, also a very formidable force, following him around, really encouraging his progress. And so I'm wondering about that kid. Are we also seeing a pattern of like this Asian tiger parent thing going on with him? I don't know. It's kind of an interesting thing. One of the things too, we have to just talk about that's so amazing with like who makes it, who doesn't, is do you have some familial structure who is pushing you. And in most cases, it's turning out to be a dad, at least the ones anecdotally that I'm kind of like following around, right? Bobby's dad was also very present, you know? And so I don't know what's going on with Chris for you. I still think that kid is one of the main talents of the country. So, you know.
Yeah, he's super talented. I think I heard his dad was saying on Facebook, I think he's been having like some health issues last couple of months. So that's why he hasn't been playing as much. But as far as I understand, I mean, they're very dedicated. I believe he was, I believe he was homeschooled, which is, I think a pretty common, factor for a lot of top juniors. Like if I remember correctly, I think Jeffrey Zhang was also homeschooled. So that tends to happen when they're focusing on chess.
Yes.
So they can kind of like, you know, just get what they need from the homeschooling and then keep the focus where it matters for sure.
Yeah. I want to mention one random little fact that I just thought was really cool. Carissa Yip was third in the U.S. under 20 female championships this year. And then she won the U.S. women's championship. Alice Lee was first in that and third in this one. So I just think that's like amazing that you could be third in the junior championship and win the overall championship. So cool little thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we'll tackle one last format question outside of the players.
I just want to say, I think last year, I think Jen, you won both the junior, the girls junior, and then the U.S. women's championship back to back, which it's kind of surprising.
Yeah. It's actually hard to do.
Okay. Format question.
So here's my question to you. Last question, right? Maybe like a slightly two-parter if you feel like it. So we'll start with, are you happy with the consistent format? The fact that for several years in a row, it's like 12 players, one round, round robin, same rest days, even same setup. Or do you have any ideas for how to make the U.S. championships and U.S. women's championships even better?
Okay. I have one idea. I love the format. I want a return, and this is, back in the day, you had a U.S. championship. It was also a very important interzonal qualifier. Now, it is to a certain extent still helping you to qualify to certain events, but it's not the same structure that it used to be. And when I say interzonal qualifier, I mean for the world championship. So, like, it was a huge stepping stone. Not just for the U.S., but for other countries as well. If you win, then you're going to be seeded into what was then the interzonal. And I want it to become something like that because it puts more, it should have that kind of stake for every country to be an advancing stepping stone to gain the world championship. So that's what I would like to see.
Yeah, I think it is a World Cup qualifier usually.
Right.
But I don't know how that works because it's like World Cup is every 2 years. So I don't like, so it's going to be next year. So I don't know.
And all these players are going to be playing in that anyway. So it's not like, you know, you get some special, you're gaining some special spot by winning it, you know? Coming second or third.
Personally, I like the round robin format just because it's like, it's very historic, you know, it was round robin for a long time. Got all these stories, got like the Fisher, like 11-0. And then, yeah, if you start mixing up the format too much, of course, it's going to mess with the numbers, you know, in terms of like if they somehow make it rapid or make it like knockout matches, you know, just like switches it up that, it's like you're counting different tournaments at that point. So I don't know. I mean, with the round robin, one like potential issue is that, you know, you have two players fighting for first place and they're playing opponents that have been out of the tournament for many rounds. In the U.S. Women's Championship, though, like this turned out to be really interesting because both Carissa and Begum lost their final rounds. Carissa lost to Ru Yang Yan, who at that point hadn't even won a game in the tournament. Right. But as far as I heard, she really wanted to win a game. So she was, in fact, a very dangerous opponent for Carissa at that time. Begum was playing Jennifer Yu. Jennifer had like up and down events, you know, but not really in contention anymore. And so that ended up being really exciting that, you know, they both had these like difficult last round games. So I don't know if it like if that really affects things a whole lot. So yeah, it's hard to say how I would change the format.
I want to make an amendment to what I said. Like, yes, I want to talk about the qualifying to something else, but also the qualifying to needs to be fixed. So here's the current thing, as I understand it. The U.S. Junior gets in, fine, I'm okay with that. And then also the person who wins the U.S. Open. But mm-hmm. The U.S. Open is a chump tournament. It's like, it's not that competitive. Not that many strong players are even playing in it. And the only people playing in it are like, maybe I'll gain a spot to the U.S. Championship. And let me just dial it back a little bit. From the period of 2000 to 2009, it was a much bigger tournament where there was qualifications. You could qualify through a number of ways. Me and David qualified back in the day. I played a bunch of U.S. championships that way. And I'm fine with it being a round robin tournament. And the thing, though, that needs to happen is that at least that one spot needs to be decided in a more cool way. You could make it the amount of points that you win through a number of tournaments. You could have a couple, like one big tournament, like that's very serious to see who gets in. But that should be decided in a more competitive format, at least that one spot. It might be cool to even have two spots just to open it up to a sense of like, oh, anybody could get in or has a chance to get in through this other spot, you know? So it gives the whole chess scene from, you know, in a more vertical way, more possibility of daylight of looking into it, you know, and getting into the tournament that way. My last U.S. championship I played, actually, I won the U.S. Open, and that's how I got in there, you know? And before that, there was a variety of other ways to get in. And that was like that time I got in, which was 2010, I think. That was like the first year they have the current format. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually my biggest suggestion. It's not even, in a sense, the U.S. championship itself, but it's the qualification process. I would love to see something really, really cool and interesting done with the qualification process, because we've reached this point where there's so much depth, and like basically you have to be 2700 or 2698, right, to be getting into the tournament. And also you could be 2698 and basically you go through the tournament, you know, with 0-1 wins and maybe one loss, and your result doesn't seem that exciting. And it's like, is it such a big deal, you know, that we've got Sem Savian in the country? Well, yes, it is. You know, he's not just filler. Like, he's a big deal, you know? So I would love to see like those guys like crushing qualifying tournaments, you know, and sort of providing an interesting level of competition for players in the country rated 2600 to 2670. Mm-hmm. So they've got a chance to get beat down by Savian and Robson, you know? And so we can be excited and be like, those guys won tournaments, you know, and now they're in the U.S. championships. So I think we should do something more exciting with it. And I don't know the details of how the Russian championship works, but the Russian championship is always called like the highest they've got some kind of a league system, right?
Right.
And I'd be curious to hear how they do it and see if that might be a cool thing to do, where they're sort of like different levels. You can like fight your way up, and it could be an accomplishment to get into the U.S. championship.
Yeah.
It's already an accomplishment, right? But a more interesting competitive accomplishment than just like your rating was at a certain level. And
yeah, back in the day, the Soviet thing was great, dude. They had the quarterfinal, they had the semifinal, you know, and then you made it to the top. What a great system, dude.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And those quarterfinals, dude, you look at those names and you're like, oh, dang, that was some stiff competition, man.
And they were playing like 25-round tournaments, too. So it was like, it was brutal.
Yeah.
And I think that would be really great for the whole country's chess culture to sort of work towards the pinnacle of that event.
That does seem like a cool system. Yeah, they have these like leagues. Though I feel like for several years, the Russian like super final, so like the you know, final tournament, I feel like it wasn't like as stacked as it could have been. Like it seemed like a lot of the top players, like Kramnik, I think, wouldn't play every year. Maybe Nepo, like a few other guys. So it wasn't, for whatever reason, I don't know why, but it didn't seem like it was always as stacked as it could have been. So I don't know if that has to do with the format or the prize fund. It could be any number of things, but that definitely is an interesting system. Yeah, I do think Right. There needs to be some qualifier for everyone. The US Open is this kind of one tournament, which I think is admittedly pretty strong. Like usually you get several like 2600s playing that event. I do like the idea they do these like tournaments of state champions. So for like the US senior, you have a qualifier spot through the senior tournament of state champions. So that would be interesting if they had just an overall tournament of state champions where you get one qualifier from every state and they come, they play this like 9-round event. And then the winner of that qualifies into the US championship. Cause then what that would do is that would encourage a lot of people to play their local state championship, which usually aren't that strong. Because if you're like the strongest player, then there's not much incentive. I know in like Southern California, you know, there's like tons of GMs that like skip the Southern California championship because it's just not that competitive. Prize fund's not that big. So, yeah, that's definitely interesting. I feel like it's not going to happen, though. I feel like for so many years, the US Open, that's been its like its main asset, this like one qualifier ticket to the US championship. And it's hard to see US chess letting that go. Because otherwise, the US Open is going to be
much weaker. You know, semifinal leagues or tournament of state champions, and then all the state championships get better, right? It's just like the benefits actually rain down on the whole community. And let me say one other totally different thing. We talked about women becoming professionals in chess in the US. Like with all the money that's in chess right now, with the big chess boom supposedly and growing the game, blah, blah, blah. How have we not had another professional chess player since Irina Krush became a professional like almost 20 years ago? Like, is there not enough money in all of American chess to support 10 professional female chess players? Well, I mean, if the money were enough, somebody would take it.
I mean, Irina's making her money not on playing, and for decades now she's been like teaching and stuff, which is kind of a shame. It's like she should have been, you know, going for it. But yeah, that's totally a shame. And none of these women, like we said, we're reiterating the point at this point, but none of these women seem like they're going to go for it.
Well, as far as I know, I could be wrong, but I don't think even like the top players, like guys like Fabi, Wesley, I don't feel like they get much support. Like they get, you know, the Olympiad team, they get invites to top events, but a lot of that is just what they would be earning with or without the US Federation. So as far as I know, it's not like the top players get like funding or coaching or stuff like that. Like there's a Samford Fellowship, which goes to one person a year, which is supposed to help them become a pro. But yeah, so it's like not, I mean, I think it'd be very different if, the top five like players, top five female players were all just given some kind of stipend or some financial support, then maybe we would see more of that. But I don't think there is anything like that. It's just, okay, they can rely on the US Championship and like events that St. Louis runs to make good money off of that. But yeah, that's still like them, you know, they still have to show up, perform well in the event. They have to earn that themselves. It's not like they just get paid by virtue of being a top player.
Yeah.
All right. Food for thought for a future dojo talk.
Yeah, there we go.
How to professionalize chess. Great talk on the championships. Thanks everybody for listening to us. Kostya, thanks for being our man on the ground with his ear to the
no problem.
The whatever, the news. And we'll see you all at the next dojo talk. All
right. Thanks, guys.